Okay, so when you think about cherubims, what comes to mind? Probably something kind of cute, right? Like a rosy-cheeked winged baby, maybe with a little bow, like on a Valentine's card.
Yeah, that's the popular image for sure. From, classical art mostly.
Well, today we're doing a deep dive into what the Bible actually says about cherubims. And let me tell you, it's different.
Vastly different. It's complex, surprising, and honestly much more profound.
So for this, we're going straight to the texts themselves.
Absolutely. We're looking at Genesis, Exodus, Numbers, Samuel, Kings, Chronicles, Psalms, Isaiah, Ezekiel, and Hebrews. Basically, tracking them right through.
Our goal, our mission, if you like, is to figure out what they do, what they look like according to these sources, and what their significance really is.
Yeah, trying to help you see these figures with, fresh eyes.
Okay, let's unpack this. Where do they first show up?
Right at the beginning, Genesis chapter 3. This is just after Adam and Eve are expelled from the Garden of Eden.
Right, the fall.
Exactly. And the text says, God placed at the east of the Garden of Eden cherubims and a flaming sword which turned every way to keep the way of the tree of life.
Okay, so first appearance, they're guards, serious guards.
Absolutely. Formidable is the word that springs to mind. Not cute at all. Their job is clear. Block access to the tree of life.
Guarding sacred access. And that flaming sword adds to the intensity, doesn't it?
It really does. It's dynamic, powerful. It sets the tone for them being these protectors of divine boundaries. A really strong opening image.
Definitely. Okay, so from Eden's gatekeepers, where do we go next?
We jump forward quite a bit to the instructions for the tabernacle, the portable sanctuary for the Israelites in the wilderness.
And specifically the Ark of the Covenant.
That's right. Exodus gives these incredibly detailed plans, and cherubims are central.
How so? What does it say?
It says to make two cherubims of gold, of beaten work, placed right on the ends of the mercy seat.
The mercy seat. That's the lid of the ark, yeah.
Yeah.
Seen as like God's throne.
Or footstool, yeah. The focal point of God's presence. And these cherubims were part of it, hammered out of the same piece of gold. Integral.
And their posture, it sounds very specific.
It is. Wings stretched forth on high, covering the mercy seat. And their faces looking one to another toward the mercy seat.
So they're focused inward towards the center, covering this sacred spot, engaged, not just decorative.
Precisely. And their placement is absolutely key. This is where God says he will meet with Moses.
Oh, right. Exodus and Numbers both say that, don't they?
Yes. From above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubims, that's the spot for divine communication.
So the cherubims literally mark the place of God's presence and where he speaks from.
Exactly. It becomes a defining phrase. Samuel, Chronicles. They talk about the Lord who dwells between the cherubims. It's shorthand for his presence among his people.
Wow. And it wasn't just on the ark, right? Weren't they also like woven into the curtains?
They were. Exodus mentions the tabernacle curtains and the veil separating the Holy of Holies having cherubims of cunning work woven into them.
Cunning work implies real skill, artistry.
Definitely. So they're surrounding you in this sacred space. It's an immersive, symbolic environment they're creating.
Which just reinforces that idea of God dwelling among them, marked by these figures.
Absolutely. You see it echoed in Psalms, Isaiah, Kings. You who dwell between the cherubims. It's this consistent marker of his accessible yet holy presence.
Okay, so that's the tabernacle, the portable setup. What happens when they build the permanent temple in Jerusalem under Solomon? Do the cherubims change?
They definitely scale up big
How
time.
big?
Well, 1 Kings tells us Solomon put two massive cherubims inside the inner sanctuary, the most holy place, made of olive wood.
Olive wood, not gold this time.
Made of olive wood, but then overlaid entirely with gold. So still incredibly valuable and huge.
Yeah.
Each one was 10 cubits high.
10 cubits, that's what, about 15 feet tall?
Roughly, yeah. Monumental figures. Imagine walking into that space and seeing these towering golden beings.
Wow, and their wings.
Even more impressive, maybe. Chronicles says their total wingspan was 20 cubits.
So, like 30 feet across.
Exactly. Stretching the entire width of the most holy place. Their wings touched the outer walls and met right in the center of the room.
That's hard to even picture, just filling the space. And facing inward towards the center.
Yes, faces inward like the tabernacle ones, focused on the ark beneath them.
So their function is similar, covering the ark.
Right. Kings and Chronicles say they spread out their wings over the place of the ark, and the cherubims covered the ark and the staves thereof, physically sheltering the holiest object.
But it wasn't just those two giant statues, was it? I remember reading, they were kind of everywhere in the temple.
They really were. That's another fascinating aspect. They were carved upon all the walls of the house round about, on the doors, even on decorative panels and furnishings.
And often shown with other things, like palm trees.
Yeah, palm trees, open flowers, sometimes lions and oxen too, depending on the passage and location, like on the furnishings described in 1 Kings 7.
What do you make of that? Just decoration or something more?
I lean towards something more. Their sheer ubiquity, alongside symbols of creation like trees and powerful animals. It suggests they're part of this picture of cosmic order, maybe.
Like, the temple is a microcosm of God's creation, and the cherubim are key figures within it, guardians of that order.
That's a good way to put it. It turns the whole temple into this symbolic representation of God's heavenly throne room, his dwelling place, and they're integral to that image.
Okay, this is interesting. Now, there's a phrase in 1 Chronicles 28 that always jumps out at me. It mentions the plans David gave Solomon, including gold for.
Yes. The pattern of the chariot of the cherubims that spread out their wings and covered the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord.
Chariot of the cherubims? That sounds different. More active, maybe.
It absolutely does. It introduces this idea of mobility, of movement. It suggests they're not just static guardians, but could be associated with God's movement, his dynamic presence.
Like they could transport the divine presence.
Or at least represent that capacity. It's a fascinating hint, a bridge, really, to what we see in the prophet Ezekiel.
Right, Ezekiel. This is where things get really wild, isn't it? The descriptions become much more visionary, symbolic.
Definitely. We move from sort of architectural descriptions to direct prophetic visions. And Ezekiel explicitly says the living creatures he sees are, in fact, cherubims.
He makes that connection himself.
Yes. In chapter 10, he sees these incredible beings by the river Chebar in Babylon and says, "This is the living creature that I saw by the river of Chebar. And I knew that they were the cherubim."
And what did these living creatures look like in his vision?
Well, it's complex. He mentions seeing something like a sapphire stone as the appearance of the likeness of a throne appearing above them.
A throne above them, suggesting they're upholding or carrying the divine throne.
That's certainly the implication. He also sees the form of the man's hand under their wings.
A human hand. Interesting detail. And the faces. Isn't that where it gets really complex? Sometimes two faces, sometimes four.
It can be a bit confusing comparing different passages within Ezekiel. The main vision in chapter 1 describes the living creatures as having four faces each. A man, a lion, an ox, and an eagle.
Okay, four faces.
But then later in chapter 41, describing carvings in a visionary temple, he mentions cherubims having two faces, a man and a young lion.
So variation even within one prophet's visions or descriptions.
Exactly. It highlights that these are symbolic visions, perhaps emphasizing different aspects. The four faces might represent all of creation, while the temple carvings simplify it. But the core identity as cherubim remains.
What else stands out in Ezekiel's vision? The movement.
Oh, absolutely. Their mobility is key. They're connected to these incredible wheels within wheels full of eyes that move whenever and wherever the creatures move. They don't turn when they move. They go straight forward.
Wheels full of eyes.
Wow. Yeah, it's intense imagery. And they can lift up their wings to mount up from the earth. They move with incredible speed and purpose, directed by the Spirit.
So very dynamic, not fixed like the temple statues.
Not at all. And the sound they make, Ezekiel describes the sound of their wings as like the voice of the Almighty God when he speaks. Just immense power.
And they interact with fire?
Yes, there's fire moving among them, and one is instructed to take coals of fire from between the cherubim, suggesting a role in divine judgment or purification.
But the most crucial link seems to be with God's glory, right?
Absolutely central. Ezekiel sees the glory of the Lord, this visible manifestation of God's presence positioned above the cherubim.
Moves with them.
Yes. He describes the glory departing from the temple threshold and resting over the cherubim. And then as they lift their wings and leave, the glory of God goes with them. They are, in effect, the bearers or the chariot of God's manifested glory.
It's an incredible, powerful image. God's presence isn't tied to a building. It's mobile, sovereign, conveyed by these amazing beings.
Exactly. It would have been a powerful message for the exiles in Babylon. God isn't stuck in Jerusalem. His glory can be present anywhere, even with them.
Okay, so after the intensity of Ezekiel, is there anything else?
There's a final sort of summary mention in the New Testament in the book of Hebrews.
What does Hebrews say?
It's brief. We're discussing the tabernacle setup. Hebrews 9.5 mentions the cherubims of glory shadowing the mercy seat. The author says they can't speak of these things in detail right now, but
it confirms that core connection. Cherubim's glory mercy seat.
Precisely. It pulls that thread all the way from Exodus through to the New Testament understanding, reinforcing their role as figures associated with God's glorious presence and the place of atonement.
So looking back over this whole journey, we started with these fierce guardians in Eden.
Mm-hmm. Then the golden figures on the ark, marking God's dwelling place.
Then the enormous ornate carvings filling Solomon's temple.
And finally, Ezekiel's dynamic, almost living chariots of God's glory.
It's quite a transformation, or maybe an unfolding revelation of their nature.
I think so. The consistent thread is their connection to God's direct presence, his power, his holiness, his glory.
They're always found where God is most powerfully present, or where access to him is being controlled or marked.
Exactly. Guarding sacred space, marking the point of communion, bearing his glory, they're far more than just angels or decorations. They seem intrinsically linked to the very manifestation of God in the world.
So the provocative thought then, if these powerful, glorious beings are so consistently tied to God's presence and actions across all these different parts of the Bible, what does that tell us?
Well, what does their presence reveal about how the ancients understood divine access or protection or even communication?
It suggests these things aren't casual. Access to God is guarded. His presence is awe-inspiring, maybe even dangerous.
Right. And his glory isn't static. It's dynamic, powerful, mobile. The cherubim seem to embody all of that. They aren't just symbols of the narrative. They feel like active participants in it.
Definitely makes you rethink that image of the chubby baby with wings, doesn't it?
Completely. They represent something much deeper, more powerful, and central to understanding the divine presence in these texts.
If you enjoyed this study and would like to learn more, please go to revelationwithdaniel.com and search for Angels Studies. You will find a growing list of this type of podcasts.